When the elders asked me to talk about the development of the canon, I immediately thought about, well, how did we get the 66 books that we have that are typically included in the Bible that you would go to the store and purchase? And as I began to research this even more, I have begun to expand kind of the way that I'm thinking about the development of the canon. So we're going to start tonight with some definitions. Definitions are always really critical. If you've heard me preach for very long, you know that I'm a definitions kind of guy. So tonight we'll try to define this term canon. It's a word that in itself doesn't appear in any English translation of the Bible that I'm aware of. I didn't look at all of my translations, but the ones that are commonly in use don't ever use this term canon. But they do use words that are a translation of the same word that canon comes from. This word canon comes from a Greek word. The Greeks spelled it with a K. We spell it with a C. It's number 2583 according to Strong's numbering system. And this word canon means a straight read or a measurement standard that can be applied to a person's manner of life. So let's look at how the New Testament writers use this term canon, and that's going to be our guide. It's going to be what informs all of our discussion. So in Galatians 6, would somebody like to read verse 16?
I got to read.
Go ahead.
And those who will walk by this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God.
Okay. So you're reading from the King James translation. Am I right, Lenny?
No, I don't use that. I use the New American Standard.
Okay. Interestingly, it's precisely the same as the reading in the King James translation. It uses this word rule. As many as walk by this rule. Somebody read 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. We're going to read verses 13 and then 15 and then 16. Matt, I think you were volunteering to read before. Can you read that one?
Yeah, I can do that. We, however, will not boast beyond measure, but within the limits of the sphere which God appointed us, a sphere which especially includes you. Not boasting of things beyond measure, that is, in other men's labors, but having hope that as your faith is increased, we shall be greatly enlarged by you in our sphere to preach the gospel in the regions beyond you, and not to boast in another man's sphere of accomplishment.
Okay, so here in 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, he uses the word measure in the King James, or in the New American Standard, I believe he uses this same word. In some other newer translations, here in 2 Corinthians 10, it also uses the term rule. So we will not boast without rule. There's an appropriate way for us to talk about the things that we have done. And in the version that you were reading, Matt, it uses the word measure. Again, it's pretty much the same thought. We're going to recognize that there is a prescribed way for us to behave ourselves, and we're going to abide by that prescribed way. That's the word canon. Philippians, the third chapter, at verse 16. Can I get somebody to read that one?
I will. However, let us keep living by the same standard to which we have attained.
Okay. So it's rule in some of the newer English versions, but you were reading from...
King James.
Okay. So in the King James, it's rule. In some others, it's standard. But the point is that there existed, when the apostles were writing, the notion that there was a rule that we were supposed to live by. This same idea is used in the secular world. When I was teaching at Eastern Washington University, I taught the class on ethics for school psychologists. And the textbook that we used for our ethics class was the Canons of School Psychology. So it's the way that you're supposed to behave yourself. So let me take a break here and let me think about having a measurement standard or some kind of a rule. And we'll talk about a few things that are going to be important as we talk about how this notion of the rule for our behavior developed. Now let's just imagine that I'm trying to build a house and I want the thing to stand up straight. I want it to be square, and I need to get my foundation level, because if I don't get my foundation level, my house is going to be tilted kind of like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and you're going to be afraid that the thing will fall down. So I don't want that to happen. I want to have a level standard for building my house. And my father-in-law was a collector of old tools. It would not have been unlike him to hand me something that looked kind of like this. And he would say, you can use this because this is a level. And I might look at that and say, well, you know, that I know what it purports to be. It says that it's a level, but it's probably been around for a whole lot of years, and it's been beat up, and it's been thrown in the back of pickup trucks and thrown into people's toolboxes. And I don't know if that thing works really very well right now. So I the first thing I might do is I might take it and try to see if it's level by comparing it to itself. And the way you do that is you put it on the two things that you're trying to measure, see if they're the same height, see if they're level with each other. And you get the measurement of level with it on there one way, and then you pick it up and turn it like a helicopter, and you put it on there the other way. And if it reads the same in both directions, then that's the way that a carpenter most of the time checks his level to make sure that it's measuring the way it's supposed to measure, that it's a good standard to use. But I had a level at one time. My level, when you did that and turned it in for in, it showed that things were level when obviously they weren't. That's because the little bubble that was in my level got messed up. And that little bubble didn't let, the little glass vial that was in there, didn't let the bubble move freely. So it just always stayed level. Now that's not a good level. Sometimes you could calibrate your level if you had a worry that it wasn't measuring the way it was supposed to measure. Well, you could calibrate your level by comparing it to some other levels. And if I had suggested to my father-in-law that I needed to check this level to see if it was any good using a comparison method, well, he'd have probably handed me two other levels that looked even more beat up than the one that he'd handed me in the first place. And if you're familiar with what a wooden level goes through when it's thrown into the back of a pickup truck, and it kind of winds up looking like that one in the upper corner, you're probably not going to think that that's a very good comparison for you to use, because that level may not be any good either. Same with the one on the bottom. That one's been laying around in the rain, and it's rusted, and it's got all kinds of problems. So I might conclude that my level was a good level because I compared it to other levels, but the other ones that I compared it to weren't any good either. So I'm not getting anywhere. I need a better way to calibrate my level to make sure that it's telling me that things are level when they really are level. And I did have a good friend that built his whole house using a level that didn't read level. His name was Gary Lee, and you've probably heard me talk about him before. But by the time he got up to the third floor in his house, you could look at the floor and you could tell that things weren't level. So what's a way that I could determine whether my level that my father-in-law has given me is a good level, whether it's giving me reliable information without running afoul of comparing it to some other things that might not be any better? Well, it turns out that you can get away from the concept of having a carpenter spirit level, and you can use something called a water level. Is anybody familiar with a water level? You know what it is? You take a glass or a plastic tube, you screw it onto the end of a water hose on both ends, and then you pour water into the water hose, and the water will always rise to level, and there's almost nothing that can go wrong with that system as long as your hose is not kinked. That's going to tell me something about level. And what it does is it gets me away from using just a carpenter's level, and now I have something that's more reliable, and it's of a slightly different nature than my carpenter's level. So I can be a little bit more confident that it really is going to work. Now, let's take these ideas and let's put them into the question of finding writings in the first century that I could rely upon that would tell me how I was supposed to live my life. And there are a lot of different kinds of writings that are floating around in the first century. I've got the Old Testament. I've got other writings that came from the period of the Maccabees. And if you're familiar with 1st and 2nd and 3rd and 4th Maccabees, it's the recording of Maccabean revolt. It's not quite contemporaneous, but you can learn a lot about the Roman authorities and the way that the Roman authorities related to the Jews during that time when you read 1st and 2nd and 3rd and 4th Maccabees, they're very good books. They don't claim to tell you everything that you need to know about the way that you're supposed to live, but they do give us some really good information about history. They also had groups of writings that had been put together by Jewish rabbis. They were called the Mishnah if they were of one type. If they were of another type, they were called the Targum. But these writings are kind of like commentaries that are written by rabbis. And they're pretty good for reading. But you, as you read them, you get the notion that the rabbi was writing not so much without regard to his own personal fortune, but it's almost as if he's writing to build up his particular understanding of biblical information, especially Old Testament information. So it's good for reading, but you have to remember that the guy that wrote it wasn't really trying to write apolitically. And we're going to see that that was the case when people started assembling a set of letters or books that they could rely on. Some people did that with an unholy motive. They were trying to build up their own particular sect. And usually the sect was the Gnostic sect. And we'll talk more about that as we continue our discussion. And then you had some writings that claimed to be dispositive. They claimed to tell you everything that you needed to know about your relationship with God and the way that you were supposed to live your life as a follower of God. So you've got some things that are good for learning about particular ideas. I talked a little bit about Caesar's Gallic Wars. It's a good book to understand something about the way that the Roman army worked. But it's not a very good book if you're trying to figure out how many heathens Caesar killed in each one of his battles, because he would have wiped out the population of Gaul. And that wasn't the case. Some things are good for reading, like the Mishnah, the Targum, and commentaries. And then there are some things that were viewed as being dispositive. And what that means when I say that it's dispositive is that it was a collection of letters, or we now refer to them as books. They were originally written as letters, and they were the final authority for all things that related to God's will for mankind. And you have to remember that there's a distinction between the kinds of writings that were extant during the first century. Now, there was, during the first century, a collection of letters or books that were regarded as dispositive. The early Christians viewed them in that way. They didn't, generally speaking, arrange them the way that we have them arranged. They took all of the letters that Paul wrote and they kind of collected those into a book. They had the Gospels because they were a little bit different. They dealt with the life of Christ, and so they put the Gospels together, regardless of who had written the Gospel. Then they had Peter's epistles, and they had John's epistles. And they worried about some books. They didn't know what to do with Hebrews, and they didn't know what to do with Jude. But these books were generally regarded by Christians as early as the first century as being dispositive. Now, it's also important to remember that first century Christians had an advantage that we don't have. If they had a letter that purportedly came from Paul, and they wondered whether or not this was a book that they ought to regard as authoritative, well, they could ask Paul, because he might come through town and they would have a copy of the letter and they could show it to him and they could ask him about this. Same with Peter, same with John, same with any of the apostles that had written letters to them. So it was regarded as dispositive by the early Christians, and it was regarded as dispositive by the early writers. Now, why was it dispositive? What made it authoritative? Well, think back to how we figure out whether we've got a good level or not. We could compare it to itself, and we pick it up and turn it around like a helicopter, and we'd measure going the other direction. But we've seen there can be some problems with that. We could compare it with some other things that we have, but there could be some problems with that. These early Christians had this one tremendous advantage as they tried to put together the letters that would tell them how they were supposed to live their life and what letters could be relied upon as a canon. They knew what Jesus said. Some of the people had been with Jesus. They'd heard what Jesus had to say. They'd heard what the prophets had to say. So they could take a letter, they could compare it to a sermon that they had heard Jesus teach. They could compare it to a prophecy that had come by inspiration in a particular situation that dealt with the same kind of question. So they had a tremendous advantage, and they could figure out whether this letter had the same character as something of another genre. They could compare the letter to the written word, or the spoken word by Jesus, or the spoken word by one of the prophets. That's important. And they were regarded as dispositive in nature because they were regarded as having come from God. You don't start with the notion of inspiration. You start with the question of whether or not I ought to rely on these things as a canon, whether I ought to put any confidence in them. And they could figure this out. They typically regarded a letter as being canon or worthy of that status if it was written by an apostle. Well, why is that really critically important? Because the apostles were eyewitness to the accounts that they were describing. Remember, they had been with Jesus during his personal ministry. So when they wrote about something that Jesus said, they were writing about it as an eyewitness. And we could talk for a long time about their credibility as eyewitnesses. Now, many of them are put to death because they would not recant what they had said. So that lends some notion of credibility to them as an eyewitness. And on top of that, they had been given the promise by Jesus of the Spirit that would lead them into all truth. So the fact that this was a letter that was written by an apostle meant that it was worthy of being included in canon. If it was written by an associate of apostles, then they were accurate by firsthand transmission from an apostle. And that would be like someone like Luke. Luke, of course, wrote the book of Acts. He had been traveling with the apostle Paul, whose travels make up a large portion of the corpus of the book of Acts. So Luke writes about that as if he was an eyewitness. And then there's some question about James, whether James was written by James the apostle or whether it was written by James, the brother of Jesus, and whether those two were the same. But regardless of that, we could say that it was written by an associate, somebody who was there who had firsthand knowledge, who might not have been an apostle. And you have to remember, they would know if an apostle had written the letter. They could ask the apostle, "Did you write this?" It might be that they were such a close associate of the apostle Paul that when he says, "See how big a letter I've written with my own hand," they would recognize his handwriting. It might be that they would rely on the testimony of the person who brought them the letter. You have to remember, they didn't get these things via email that can be so easily manipulated. When they got a letter, it was probably delivered by one of the people that had been traveling with the Apostle Paul. And sometimes he talks about how Timothy had written these, had brought these letters to them. And so they would have an advantage in knowing whether or not the letters that they were considering ought to be part of canon, or part of the rule that you are going to live by. Now, how do we know that they had a difference, that they recognized a difference in these kinds of literature that were extant during the first century? Remember, they've got things that were written between the close of the Old Testament, the beginning of the New. They've got things that were written by people with unholy motives. They've got things that were written as commentaries. So how do we know that they recognized that there was a difference in the quality of the letters that they were considering? The earliest kind of evidence comes from the way that the early Christians described the use of the letters that they had. And they talked about some letters as being appropriate to read in the public assembly. And, you know, sometimes the writers of the letters indicated that the letter was to be read in one place, and then it was to be read in other churches as well. So the first way that we know that they had recognized that there was a distinction in the quality or the inherent nature of the letters was that some things were useful to be read in the public assembly, and others could be read in private. They had value. Clement of Alexandria wrote a number of different letters. He's probably one of the most prolific of the early Christians who wrote letters. But he wrote letters that were intended to be used in private. There's a second way that we know that the early Christians recognized a difference in the inherent nature of the letters, because there were some letters that were universal in their application. Sometimes the letters were specifically addressed to a single church, but the writer of the letter says you ought to have this read in other churches as well. Some things are not specifically addressed to an individual or a particular church, but they're broader in their application. So anytime a letter was intended to be universal and was regarded as worthy of being universal, we know that that was a recognition that there was a distinct difference in the essential character or nature of some of the letters that they had. And then some of the letters that they had weren't intended to function throughout all time, but they were for a present time. There was something that was going to happen, and they needed to be warned about it, but it really didn't have any impact on people who were not going to be experiencing the events that are described in the letter. So if they perceived that it was universal as opposed to a letter that had a limited time reference, then again, we know that they made a difference in the essential character or nature of the letter and whether or not it would be included in the measure or the rule by which they were going to live their lives. And then just as a practical sense, some letters were regarded as so valuable that you would preserve that letter under every circumstance. And the early Christians had to deal with a lot of persecution, especially beginning as early as the 200s. The Roman hierarchy, the Roman government, began to seize the property of the early churches. There's pretty good indication that the early churches did own property, because when the Emperor Constantine wrote the edict that recognized Christianity and allowed Christians to meet together for worship, one of the things that he did was he returned the property that had been seized from churches. So we know churches had property. We know that they typically kept books or these letters. And the question is, if the Roman authorities came and they were going to seize your property, would you take great pains to preserve the letters? Or would you just let them go, like the building where you met for assemblies, or where you cared for those who were widows indeed? You might have had a building in which you cared for them. So in a purely practical sense, we can read the early Christians' writings and look for instances where they said, we need to preserve this letter at even unto the point of death. But the other things, we can let them go. The commentaries that you got, sure, it's nice to have the commentary, but would you preserve it to death? Under penalty of death, would you be willing to keep this book? Would you be willing to rush back into a burning building to rescue this letter because this letter had that much value to you. And we see the early Christians talking about that kind of thing. I said last week that that's something that we may have to consider in the future. What's worth preserving? And what's just nice to have? I really do worry that we're going to have to make those kinds of decisions in the not too distant future. So that kind of sets the stage for what we're talking about. Now this, you know, it always bothers me when I analyze something and I see something that I've never read anyone else talk about. If it's unique to me, it always worries me because I'm just not that smart, and I'm not sure that I'm smart enough to ever come up with anything that's original. If other people talk about it and they talk about it in the same way that I am, then I'm reasonably confident that I'm on the right track. I don't believe I've ever heard this discussion that we have gone through tonight in any of the literature that I have read or any of the discussions that I have been a part of that dealt with the canon. So take it with a grain of salt. Understand that this is the best reasoning that I can come up with, but understand that it's reasoning. It's not reasoning to say that they had a rule, and it's not reasoning to say that there were some things that were part of that rule and some things that weren't. But it is reasoning when I talk about some of the ways that they would go about including things in the rule. So just bear that in mind as you consider the things that we've been talking about tonight. Like I said, sometimes I get a little far and off into the weeds, and Kim will testify that I do that more often than I should, but I hope this is helpful. And I always want us to come back to the idea that when the early Christians looked at the value of certain writings, they were looking at it to determine whether it was part of canon. If it was part of the definitive information about the way that we were supposed to live our lives. Okay, let's open this up for questions and comments.
Dean?
Yeah.
The thing that kind of got me when you mentioned it is I've never heard of it, you know, so far as the Church of Christ goes. I'd always heard canon when people were talking about the Catholic Church. And I just always, I didn't want to know about it. I didn't want to discuss it or anything. But I never tried to find out what it was, really, just only that it was seemingly connected with the Catholic Church.
Well, the Catholic Church will tell you. They're not bashful about taking credit for things that they didn't do. But they will tell you that the reason that the canon exists is because the Catholic Church in the 300s had a conference at which they determined the canon. And they might point to Jerome and his assembling of books for the Emperor Constantine. And they might say, well, the canon exists because the Catholic Church determined what was to be in the canon and what was to be left out. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think what they did was, if anything, they recognized what had already been recognized by the early Christians.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the Catholic Church gave us the Bible as it exists today.
Well, I'm glad that we've got, you know, you're doing this, because it's giving me some, you know, so I don't freak out when somebody mentions it to me.
Well, I enjoy doing the reading. I enjoy doing the thinking. This kept me up for two nights, because I couldn't find a way to put this together so that it made sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
When you think of the Catholic Church and you look at history, it was established in 606 AD. And these early Christian writers who were collecting the writings of the Bible determined that back in 2nd, 3rd century.
Even the end of the 1st century.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a very good point. So just from the standpoint of time, this idea that there was a rule that we were supposed to live by had been in existence ever since the beginning of the church.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church didn't give us that notion.
This is good.
Well, I'm going to rely on the elders to tell me if I'm barking up the wrong tree. They're the ones that asked me to put this stuff together. And I'm hoping I'm not out in the weeds too much, but they'll let me know.
Well, I started to say thank you to them too, you know.
There's another thing that...
Yeah, this is...
We have the Bible that we can compare it with, the one that we know, mm-hmm. because it was written by the apostles and the prophets. And so we do have a good level to compare with. Anything that someone else teaches, we can find out by examining what God says. But a novice wouldn't even think about that, because they just accept what they say, because the denominations came from the Catholic Church, like Luther, and he used his own name and put his own thoughts in there. It wasn't God's word.
Mm-hmm.
And you can check other ones out too. Some of them are similar. These days they're so far off, you don't have any doubt whatsoever. You know, but we do have a good level.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
There's another thing too, because when you just read it yourself, we probably should be like Philip. We need to ask somebody that knows, or that's why we need to know what we're talking about, so that they have a reason to believe that whatever they're practicing is not right. In a delicate way, you could start like he did from the beginning, which would be the beginning of the church.
Yeah. Point well taken. Point well taken. And it's interesting. Most people never think about, well, how did the books that we have in our Bibles come to be included in our Bibles?
Maybe because they were the main letters and the others were copies, but they might not have witnessed, we have the Book of Thomas and all those others are running around, the Book of Mary or something like that.
Right.
But they were not the original. Those were the ones that were read around, I suppose. The letters are what were passed around, and that would be another level.
Right.
Dean?
Yes.
I think it always goes back to the idea that it's not like on ESPN, the 10 greatest basketball players or football players or whatever, that it's one person's opinion is this way and another person's opinion is that way. It's what was valued by the Christian community at the beginning of time and what was passed down. And when people start pulling things out and you can say, okay, it was pulled out here, it was stuck in here, then you can see that somebody who wasn't there is trying to modify it.
Yeah, good point. Good point. That's the point that I'm trying to make. The early Christians had this notion that the earliest Christians had this notion that there were some books that were some letters that were dispositive. And there were others that they were clearly aware of that they did not regard that way. So just because there was a letter that was floating around didn't mean that it was to be regarded that way. And there's a lot of value in saying that folks in Galatia had pretty much concluded that these were the books that ought to be dispositive, and folks in Rome had concluded the same thing. And they didn't have Instagram and all of the ways to communicate back and forth that we do. There was communication, sure, but they didn't have the instant collaboration that we do. Okay. We will not have this class next week because Ted and I are both going to be gone. We'll be down in Yosemite enjoying a little bit of a vacation. We're going to go down on Monday and come back on Saturday. And so I'll be here to preach on the 4th, but we're going to take a little bit of a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the development of the Old Testament and a little bit more information about that. So no class next Wednesday or next Thursday.